Come then to the second part, and I've called it Christ-centered community. And what I really want to do, in a sense, is to think carefully about one aspect of what that means. I always, when everybody says, "Well, it goes without saying that," it always rings alarm bells for me, because I think when there are these things that, well, it always goes, there are actually things that we don't actually consider. And that actually, when we begin to actually examine these things, well, it goes without saying that we maybe discover that maybe what we thought was isn't, and that the nature of whatever it is we're talking about is we've really been living with a bit of an illusion. And so, so I say, well, church is Christ-centered community. And everybody says, well, of course, yes, that goes without saying, doesn't it? And immediately, so I think there's always a real warning, because actually God never goes without saying. You see, now, it's this interesting there that our language almost betrays us. Well, it goes without saying. Of course, the church is centered on the person of Christ. And yet, actually, I suppose the point is that I'm just trying to visualize this in a sense, that actually this idea of the sum of a sense, that actually we're moving towards God, or to move, God in Christ is our vision and our purpose. And we maybe have a sense of actually, well, this is actually a flow away from, well, church is all about this flow away from. You know, it's all about mission, or it's all about whatever. And then you realize, well, away from what? What does it mean? And so the Psalms of Ascents, of course, are drawing us. The people of God are coming closer to Jerusalem, which is the place where the glory dwells in the temple in the Holy of Holies. A few years ago, we used to take our children very regularly on Christian camps, having taken them into a rural mission context where there was nothing for young folks at all in the church. We decided it was very important that we invested as much as we could in making sure that they had lots of good faith-building experiences when it wasn't necessarily quite so easy within the church context. And I always remember taking the girls to a camp one time. It was the first time I'd been to it, and there was a youngish vicar running it, and I got into conversation. He says, "Oh, I've just gone to a new parish," he said. They said, "But I've been doing this camp for years." And I said to them, I said on interview, I said, "Look, it's a case of this, love me, love my camp." You see, because I will be doing it, and it will be part of my work, and I will not be taking a week's holiday in order to do it. But this is part of my ministry. It's always been part of my ministry. Well, I don't know if he still has a working relationship with that parish, but it was this real thing of, this is so much part of me. This is so much part of me. And that is what Christ says about the church. That is so much part of me. That was where we left things. Remember last time, we had that lovely passage from Ephesians where we spoke, where Paul begins talking about the relationship between husbands and wives, but he keeps going off into this wonderful theology of the relationship between Christ and the church. And that kind of pulls himself back, but then goes off again and finishes off by saying, "I am actually talking about Christ and the church. But husbands, love your wives, and wives, respect your husbands." And he's been drawn towards the reality of this relationship between Christ and the church. You see, and this is at the very centre of his vision. And we looked last time, didn't we, at that wonderful passage at the beginning of Ephesians, where I said, "Right, apply this to your everyday life," and it's all about Christ. It's all about Christ, and so. I spoke a little bit about, we've lost sight of the church. And I spoke about the invisible church. And you remember I had that book on prayer. And I said, how do we make the church disappear? Well, we read this book, because actually, pretty much in this book, we don't need the church. We have this now unmediated relationship with God. The church is completely unnecessary. As I said, the author doesn't say that. And actually, the author would be probably horrified to hear me say that. But it's interesting that in this most significant aspect of our faith, the life of prayer, the church is completely invisible. And so I began to, and it reminds me a wee bit of, it's one of these things that, it's one of those things that probably never happened. But the scientist Laplace, the French scientist, went to visit the Emperor Napoleon with his model of the solar system. And he'd looked at all the planets and their motions and one thing and another, and he presented the emperor it might have been an automaton, who knows, but this model of the solar system with the sun and all the planets. And Napoleon is reputed to have said to him, where does God fit in, you see? And Laplace reputedly said to him, "Sir, I have no need of that hypothesis." In other words, here is a solar God. Well, it's not necessary. God isn't necessary for the working of this. Well, that's an interesting theological thought, the necessity or otherwise of God. Well, we'll leave that to one side. But there is a sense in which, when we talk about what place does the church have in my life, talking about is, it's a sort of an aid to my faith. Or churches, we might say, church is a place where I'm fed. Or church is a place where I'm encouraged. Or church is a place where I meet with fellow Christians. And when we talk about church in those terms, and it's not uncommon to do so, we notice what we've done. We've actually said, the primary thing, of course, is about myself and my relationship with God. And here's the different ways that being part of the church helps that. We don't say, primarily, I have a relationship with God in and through the church, as a result of which I find myself in a personal relationship with God. So we see the church, as I said, ancillary to our personal relationship to Jesus. The church as a support for our faith, but not actually the living, beating heart of it. Now, I do want to say a wee bit, a little later, about what I call the heresy of pietism. It would be interesting, instructive. I don't think this is too out of line, because I can put my hand up to this one. How many of us in our faith journey have been told, it's vitally important that you have your personal relationship with God, and this is the key thing. I was told that. I was told that's a strong line. Yeah. Please don't be ashamed of this. It's true for a lot of people. It's not true for everybody, and I'm glad to hear it's not true for everybody here. That concept, if you begin to trace it back, has its historical roots actually not very long ago. People didn't used to talk in those terms prior to the middle of the 18th century, or even later. It's a fairly, in terms of the way we express it nowadays, it's a very recent figure on the block in the way in which, in terms, we speak about Christian faith. And I'm going to come back to it a little later on. But you remember also, we talked about this. So there's been the shift in the way that we understand church. Okay, and the two are to a certain extent linked together. And one of the reasons for the rise of pietism was a response against the institutionalism of the church. You see, so it was all so impersonal, was faith, because there was this institution. And particularly amongst Protestants, because it did arise out of Protestantism, there was that whole thing about the Catholic Church, this institution that we are against, and we are now liberated, and we all have our own Bibles, and out of that then really grew this highly individualistic account of faith apart from a community. Now, of course, that would never have meant in those days that you didn't, of course, you did go to church religiously as part of your piety. It would have been seen as one of those vital things. And actually, I remember, in my youth, faith being expressed to me in these things. What are the key things about faith? Well, you have to have a prayer life. You have to have a vital prayer life. You have to read your Bible frequently. You have to go to church and be part of a local church fellowship. But you notice that there's this whole list of stuff that's important, but actually that's just one of the things. And of course, that thing has actually become, in some respects, less and less significant. And so now, especially now, we have this arena of spirituality that I talked to you about, where we're all spiritual, aren't we? And we can all have our relationship with whatever this higher being is or is not. The idea of that corporate expression being central is really quite a way off at the outside. And it's very important that as we think of radical individualism of our age. Okay, I said the philosophical roots of this go back to around about the 14th century. There's a shift in people's thinking in around about the 14th century, and you can trace it now to what I call radical individualism, that we do talk about individuals, which is a strange way for us as Christians to talk. I think I only mentioned this actually at the Sunday evening thing, but actually it's not Christian to say individual. Now, I don't want to say, therefore, I don't want to kind of leap to the conclusion, right, there's no me, all there is the church. No. As Christians, we speak of the person. Now, you might think, well, isn't that the same? And the answer is no. The Christian perception of a person is that we only exist in relationship to others. If the heart of this whole message is love, then there must be an other for me to exist. Because if there is no other, there is no love. You see? And individualism, of course, at the same time, solves the problem at one thing. By the probably one of the dominant sins of our age, which is narcissism. Self-love. In other words, so this thing that is given to us by God and is part of our good and created being, this capacity for love, the more our lives become isolated, has to find something to love. And so we find ourselves rooted actually in love of ourself. And actually this whole idea of the personal relationship with Jesus then just becomes a means actually of feeding that. I think it would be interesting, really, when all the books are opened at the end of the days, to see how many folks actually, in their personal relationship, were actually just enjoying a nice quiet time with themselves. It's interesting how few of us, in a sense, get shaken up by God.
We still do need a personal relationship.
I will say that. But let's. Can I hold it? I think that just to pick up on, just to say very briefly, Verna. Yes, but it's as a result of being part of the church.
Yeah.
And it is then, so the reason I don't want to say yes, of course, is because that just leaves us in the same position. So, oh, thank goodness for that, I was right after all. You see? So I want, and so that in a sense, I'm being very negative about that, because unless you do, we're so used to that, we're so bound to that, that if I, you know, the moment I say yes, of course you do, you'll go say, oh, thank goodness for that, I can stay over in my position here and everything can stay the same. And we can all be fine and rosy.
No, that's not
right, thank you. Yeah, so yes, absolutely, we still do need that. And one of the ways in which we expressed faith, and it was a big argument, I know, in my younger years, it's not quite the same now, was we were told, on the one hand, there were all the liberals who were into a social gospel, and all the evangelicals who were into so you had two options. The whole thing was about saving the world, you know, service to the wider world, and then you had the kind of the gospel, you know, the gospel, gospel ministry, which was about making people Christians. And I remember seeing, you know, they used to say, people, so we tried to work it out, said, oh, it's like two blades of a pair of scissors, you see. But the point was, the church was absent from this. So you had two versions of what the church was about, but the church was actually absent from both of the fairly big models of what church was about. Evangelism itself, the way we think about it in our era, again, is very, very late. It's largely a 19th century revivalist American phenomenon. If you want to do some more reading, there is a web link there for you. And one of the fascinating things, and I remember being woken up to this fairly early on in my own Christian journey, was that these big evangelistic rallies, all these people got up and made these decisions for Christ and all the rest of it, all the stats show after 5 years, at least 90% of them had fallen away. Quite interesting, really, that there was something not of the sort of foundational solidity that we'd expect if we'd actually entered into a relationship with the living God. So there we are. We'll leave that. I can skip through that a wee bit. Now, I just want to explore another thread, really, of this. So we looked at individualism last week, and this week, just to look at the impact of Christendom. Now, we know the old story, don't we? Constantine gets converted, and therefore everybody now has got to be a Christian. It's not certainly not as straightforward as that. But one of the things was that actually, unless you... how can I put it? Unless we're converted, it's very difficult to go out into the world and, unless we're converted, it's very hard to understand Christianity as being different from a religion. And so, in other words, Christianity is brought into the heart of the Roman Empire, and everybody understands what a religion is. Well, we know what a religion is. You maybe have a special place, a special temple, worship, and that's the God that you bow towards. And while you're getting on with your everyday life, if your life isn't going very well, you call out to your God to fix it. And if your life's going well, we say thank you to your God. But at the end of the day, it's an appendage to life. You know, it's an appendage. Okay, so we have this, for these Romans, no different to any of us really, deeply religious beings. We have this understanding that we need a bit of help to get through life, and here's the way we're going to do it. And so it found a ready home, and of course what happened was it gets very much subverted into precisely that form of thing. That's what gradually became of it. Now, there was a counter move to this, which was in the monastic movement, and I will come back to the monastic movement a little bit further through our course. But so we had weekly worship, prayer to gods or gods, but at the same time there were other demands on our time as well. You know, the tribe being a key one, the significance of the tribe or your people. I once remember hearing the bishop of Bristol came and addressed us, and we were all. We thought he wasn't hot enough on the gospel, really, and we always pointing to the church in Africa and saying, look, it's so vibrant, and they're all becoming Christians. And he turned round to us, and he was clearly a bit annoyed, to be frank, you know, because we were basically ignorant. And he said, you know, if I went to the church in Africa, I'd say this. I said, in Christ, there are no tribes because of the tribal divisions that still existed. You know, what really mattered to people was which family you belonged to. The fact that you were Christian was not still the driving determinant. And so we have this story, and it was a bit naughty of me, but I pushed things a little bit out last week, and I said, you know, how does this fit in with our everyday life? And as soon as I say everyday life, we're already in a little bit in this outside. Well, we have a, and somebody actually said to me in one of the groups, to say, do you mean as opposed to my life in the church? And I just let the comment go. But that's the way in which we sort of think of things. Now, I just want to pick up on Justin and Jenny. I said I would mention Justin Duckworth. And that there's a wonderful moment very early on in the book where Jenny says this. So many of the folks in our church were waiting for their lives to happen. One day I hope to. When I grow up, I will. When I'm really ready. I need to start my study. I need to finish my study. I need to pay off my student loan. I need to save my overseas experience, my OE. I need to do my OE. I need to start my career. I need to plan for my wedding. I need time within my new marriage. I need to start my family. I need to get my kids through preschool years. I need to be there for them as they approach their high school years. I need to look after my aging parents. I need to save my kids' university. And it goes on and on and on. Now, the point they're making is they never have any time for any ministry because they're too busy waiting for... Well, I'm sorry, at the moment, I've got this next stage of my journey. You see? Everyday life... Well, actually, there's all this stuff that I'm absorbed in. I find Justin and Jenny's story actually very compelling and very challenging because actually they said, I wonder if the call of Christ is to this. Or is Christ calling us all to something else? So there is always other competing areas. And so, as I said last time, the difficulty then is we come to the scriptures. And because in a sense our life isn't so much about this community of faith to which this book is given, it just becomes, as it were, an aid. And so, you know, how does this help me in my everyday life? Well, it reminds me that God is here and present while I get on with the story of my life. And actually, church is not the arena of faith. Now, when I say church now, please understand that as this community. All right, not what we're doing on a Sunday, but actually that what is the arena of my life is this community of faith and our shared life together. I remember somebody saying to me that we had a house group and Sarah and I, and there was a lovely lady there called Kath, wonderful lady. She knew her Bible. She could recite all the books of the Bible. She read her Bible back to front. And one year, I said, right, we're going to have a course on discipleship this year. And the first session, she said, oh, we're not all called to be disciples. And I thought, what an extraordinary thing to say. And I hadn't thought about that. And she had immediately got, well, there's a class of people who have to devote their lives to the things of Christ. And then there's the rest of us. And she was a lovely lady, actually. On the odd occasion afterwards, I'd tease her about that. And I think we kind of shared that maybe that wasn't quite true. That actually, as the church becomes religious about going to worship and praying to your God and calling out to your God as life gets better or worse, to be an aid to your life, at that same time we see the rise of monasticism. In other words, a group of folks who say, hang on a minute, this is actually primarily about being the people of God together. And it's very interesting that at the time now, when the Christendom church has all but disappeared and or is rapidly disappearing, what are we seeing arising but new forms of monasticism? And of course, we know the Duckworth story, how they have their community up at Netanyahu. And you could replay this all over the Western world where the church is in massive decay. There are loads of them in England, new monastic communities. There are loads of them in America. They are springing up left, right and centre. The people actually entering into forms of life that are about shared life and our faith being expressed through that shared life. I used the phrase last time, going into the church. I said, you know, the idea was, well, not everybody went into the church. So I was told when I was ordained, oh, Eric, you're going into the church. That there was something that was every day. And then there was the life of the church. And the people like me were the people who were to do with the life of the church, you see. And that idea also of the religious professional, you see. So someone separated, you know, not quite. Your job was to, you know, you had a job that was a bit disconnected from the reality, in a sense. People always say to vicars, you need to get out into the real world. You know? What experience have you got of real life? You know, you're also saintly, well, or not, but, and you know, where's your connection with life in the real world? And actually, a lot of clergy effectively collude with that. You know, so, well, I'm just a religious professional. And I could actually say a great deal more about religious professionalism, which I must admit I have no time for at all. Rather than being as the priest, somebody with a particular vocation to call the community together, to name the community before God, to name what the community is, and basically to call us to common life. Now, of course, we've since tightened it all into what we do on Sunday. But what does it mean for me to be a priest through the week? And I think that's a good question. When I went to theological college, one of the things I did was I explored what was the purpose of all the work I did before. And actually, I almost now need to revisit the question and say, what is the true calling on my life for church through the week? Or am I just actually effectively working in the religious paradigm that's my job to help everybody through their everyday lives? I think there's some interesting questions to be asked there of the clergy. I think every question, in a sense, has to come to the clergy first, because, you know, we're the people, in a sense, who are called to reflect on these things and call the